Yesterday I finished with Christensen and his Hexen. I will have a little more to say about Christensen today, but sort of the main focus of today's lectures will be Dreyer and his work. So in this first lecture, I'll start out by talking about Dreyer's work at Nordisk, the beginnings of his career as a director. Then I'm going to say something about his relation with the Swedish cinema, and finally I'm going to look at the sort of wider trend of Danish filmmakers leaving the country and working elsewhere in the 1920s. This is what Nordisk Studios looked like in 1915. It's actually quite small, many of the buildings are still there. They have guided tours, so you can have a look at it if you ever come to Copenhagen. Most of the old studio buildings have been converted, so that they're used for, they don't have glass walls anymore, and they're mainly used to do television game shows and that kind of thing. One of them, the little one over on the right, was restored some years back. The glass was put back in, and you can get it's been set up with an original piece of setting, and you can sort of actually be in the place where many of the films that I've been talking about were shot. And Nordisk was a big and sort of industrialized concern, and they tried to systematize their approach in various ways, and having sort of moved decisively to longer films in 1911, and with the impact of the Autoren film, they would purchase a lot of filming rights for literary works, and quite a few of the films that they made were adaptations. And this was one of Dreyer's roles. He worked there as a screenwriter from 1913 on, and what he mostly did there, almost exclusively, was adapting novels of various sorts to film scripts. He actually also, at the same time, was sort of a literary agent. So some of the novels that Nordisk bought to film and that were adapted by Dreyer, Dreyer also sold to them. So it's kind of, I don't know, a weird business setup. But so the contract to buy the novel that Dreyer's first film as a director was based on was actually a contract between Nordisk and Dreyer, because Dreyer was the author's representative and he was the one who sold the literary rights to Nordisk. So he was wearing several hats. He also worked as an editor. Editing at this time was something that was handled without any necessary input from the directors, and basically it was considered sort of part of the lab work. From around 1915, Dreyer worked on as an editor on most of the company's films, so he got a very strong sense of the possibilities of editing that way. He also wrote intertitles for many of the films. The intertitles weren't necessarily predefined in the scripts, and he also wrote plot summaries of the finished films for use in the little program booklets that you could buy in Danish cinemas. So during this period from 13 to 18, he got a really sort of thorough schooling in various different aspects of the film production process at the time. But as I talked about yesterday, Nordisk had been very much aware of what was going on in Sweden and the sort of shifts in production policy that Svenska Bio had been very successful with. And this was not something that that Nordisk ignored. Quite the contrary. In late 1916, the company's management demanded, wrote a letter to the firm's directors, urging them to study various films that had added quality according to the company's management because of the skill with which they were directed. And the three films that they point to are Benjamin Christensen's Night of Revenge or Blind Justice, which you saw a clip from yesterday, a film by Maurits Stiller named The Ballet Dancer, of which only a fragment remains, and a film by the Danish director Alfred Lind, who was working in Italy at the time. But there was certainly also at sort of the level of management a very sort of strong idea or strong support for the idea that the director was a key figure. And the way the production process worked was that directors were responsible for choosing their own scripts. They were subject to approval by management, but it wasn't really the case that there was sort of a policy set from above that we want to make this kind of movie in order to be successful in this market. We know that in Germany they like detective films, so we are going to make more detective films. It doesn't seem to have worked that way. Rather, the responsibility for choosing which films to make, to a large extent, lay with the directors. Sort of the dissatisfaction with the directors who were at Nordisk led along. I mean, there was sort of a general cessation of production in 1917. Then it was sort of started up again in 1918, but on a much smaller level because of the problems with the World War and exporting films and so on. But when they started up again in 1918, they didn't sort of invite all the directors that they had let go back. A number of people who had made lots of films for the company in the preceding years were dismissed, and instead they sort of chose to focus on newer talent. One was A.W. Sandberg, who was originally a press photographer and who did the stills for Benjamin Christensen's Mysterious X. And he'd been working as a director since 16 at Nordisk, but he got bigger projects, and then they hired Dreyer as a director as well in 1918 and gave him the chance to make a film of his own. And in that connection, it's worth noting that by this time, even though the war meant that it was difficult to see American films in many European countries, including Denmark, word had still gotten through, and by 1918, some of the really big American movies started getting through as well. So in March 1918, Birth of a Nation had its premiere in Copenhagen, and later that year, Intolerance. And probably the print was already in Copenhagen, because it does seem that Dreyer got to see it at a closed screening in the spring of 1918. This was obviously a very influential film for many filmmakers, and many people were impressed by its sheer scale and extravagance. But that wasn't really what fascinated Dreyer, and many years later he was asked to do lists of films that had been particularly inspirational for him, and we'll return to that list later on. But the first title on the list is Intolerance, but he specified with a little parenthesis that it was the modern episode of Intolerance that he was impressed by. And I think that it was the work with the actors, the emotional intensity of the close-ups that Griffith was able to achieve, that it was that part of Griffith's art that Dreyer was particularly inspired by. I think that one can one can clearly see that this kind of that what Griffith does in Intolerance is quite similar to what Dreyer does in his first film Presidenten, which translates as the president, but the title really means the chief justice, because he's not a president of a country, he's the president of a court. So he's actually a judge, not a politician, which can be kind of confusing when you hear the title, the president. Both films, of course, feature trials, and in Intolerance, the hero, the boy, as he's called, is put on trial for his life. He's innocently convicted of murder, and Mae Marsh plays his wife, and she is obviously quite distraught about what is happening with him.
She's the one who did it.
In the president, there is a trial as well. Here it's the young woman who's on trial. The chief justice of the title has fathered an illegitimate child, and this young woman is brought up on the charge that she has had a child out of wedlock and killed it. So she is on trial for her life, and the Chief Justice realizes that this is actually his own illegitimate daughter who has turned up in these miserable circumstances. And so it's a story about how the sins of the fathers are visited upon their children, Daya's sympathies are clearly with the young lady. In the trial scene, he, like Griffith, uses editing to move about inside the courtroom and present us with views of the various participants, letting us sort of see their roles, and allowing the glances between them to create the necessary links. And this is, of course, quite different from the trial scene in The Candle and the Moth, Evangelie Mandens Liv, that I showed you, where there was this sort of set that was constructed into the depth of the fictional space, with this long rug in the middle that sort of underlined the depth of the courtroom, and the prisoner was brought forward move towards the back of the frame, then you cut in to a closer view, and then you move back again. But everything was sort of set up along this this axis that sort of followed the axis of the camera. And Dyer, as Bordwell points out in his careful analysis of the film in the essay The Dyer Generation, instead sort of places the various participants much more along the other axis, so that they're sort of side by side, so that we move to different places that are at angles to the camera, rather than moving into the depths of the image.
Mm.
the bench. Counsel for the prosecution. The representatives of the local newspapers. Forethought reveals that she was corrupted at an early age. The daughter of a woman of easy virtue. Lie, a damned lie. I admit that I deserve death and I want to die, but as God is my witness, my mother was noble and good. What she erred was in trusting an unworthy man. It took a while before the film was released, but it clearly made an impression on the Nordisk management, because the following year, 1919, Dreyer was allowed to do a really, really big budget film. It Leaves from Satan's Book wasn't released till 1921, but it was shot during 1919, and it's a story in four parts. The first one is about how Judas betrays Jesus to the authorities, so that he's taken off to be crucified. Then there is a story of the Spanish Inquisition. There is one about the death of Marie Antoinette in the French Revolution, and finally one about civil war between Reds and Whites in Finland in 1918. And in each case, the recurring figure here is Satan, who is sort of conceived as is not a malevolent figure, but one who has been sentenced by God to go about and tempt people to do evil. Here we have the different time periods, and here are Satan's guises in the various time periods. He's a Pharisee. In the first episode, he's an inquisitor. In the second, he's both a beggar and he has another role as well in the French Revolution sequence. And finally, in the Finnish Civil War sequence, he is a defrocked monk who has become a Bolshevik commissar. In the first three episodes, he tempts people to do evil, and they do. Only in the last one does someone resist him, and that means that his sentence is shortened, and he's forgiven for a little of the sin that he committed against the Lord whenever someone resists his blandishments, but that doesn't happen very often. This four-part structure with four different time periods has meant that a lot of people have compared it to intolerance, which obviously also sort of takes place over four time periods, and especially in the light of Dreyer's admitted admiration for intolerance. But it's very important to remember the modern episode, he says, and the fact of the matter is that the original screenplay for Leaves from Satan's Book, which was written by a Danish playwright, had actually been submitted to Nordisk in 1913. So years before Griffith even conceived of intolerance. Obviously, in 1913, the Finnish Civil War hadn't happened yet, and as far as I've been able to, there's at least the original script does not survive, but there is an interview with the writer where he says that it was originally set during the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-05, the final episode. But the others were substantially similar to what was made there. And so we shouldn't think of Leaves from Satan's Book as an imitation of intolerance's narrative structure. Also, Dreyer tells the episodes consecutively. He doesn't sort of intercut them the way that Griffith did. And actually, one of the Danish reviewers said, "Oh, this is much better, because the other one, that was so confusing, the way they cut back and forth." Rather, that's the way that the original screenplay is done. And quite likely, the original inspiration for both Griffith and Edgar Hoyer was an Italian film called Satana, which means Satan, from 1912, which has this four-part structure with a biblical episode and two historical episodes, and finally one that takes place in the modern world and involves class conflict. And so that concept was taken over, and of course, at exactly the same time that Dreyer was making Leaves from Satan's Book, F.W. Murnau in Germany was making a film called Satanas, which is unfortunately lost, except for a few very, very tiny fragments. And that has only three episodes, but the concept is still the same. You have three different historical time periods with Satan as the recurring figure. So this was actually sort of a figure that was reused in various contexts, and Dreyer's use of it can't really be credited to the example of D.W. Griffith. Here are some of the victims: Judas, the girl taken by the Spanish Inquisition, along young aristocrats who ends up in the guillotine in the French Revolution episode, and finally a station master's wife who is asked by Satan to save her, the life of her husband and her children, by leading the white army into an ambush by sending a false telegram, but she refuses and kills herself instead, and in that way resists Satan's blandishments. And here we have Satan as a Bolshevik preaching the Red Catechism to his followers. So obviously the film here was marked by the fear of the Red Revolution spreading from Russia that affected many European countries at the time. But I think that one of the, I mean, there are many interesting things about this film, but what I want to focus on is the way that Dreyer sort of continued the idea of using art as a model for film images. And this is from the first episode, where we have The Last Supper. And obviously, will remind us of Leonardo's Last Supper, in that we have this sort of forward-facing clothesline composition where everyone is seated on the other side of the table, so that we can all see them, and where we really have. I mean, in Anne Hollander's terms, this is very much a theatrical picture. It's very much staged in a way that sort of accepts that there are spectators out there looking at this. So obviously, you can't have a lot of people sitting on this side, sort of blocking the view of the central event that's being portrayed here, and this image has of course been a very very widely reproduced and cited one, and so it in a sense, in the words of one art historian, to sort of reuse this composition provides an aura of authenticity to Dreyer's recreation of it, meaning that the audience will sort of expect a proper Last Supper to look like the kind of Last Supper that they're used to see, which is in many cases a Leonardo-like one. And in some cases, this is Ben-Hur, from 1925, the American Ben-Hur. The resemblance with Leonardo's painting is even closer, so that the coffered ceiling, the side doors, and the table trestles are all just like in Leonardo's painting. Of course, in this case, there is an apostle on the other side of the table, namely Judas, and because showing Jesus in films was highly controversial, the makers of Ben-Hur decided to show him only from the back, or when you have to show him from the front here, the view of him is blocked by having another person sit there. And this is actually something that occurs in other Renaissance paintings of the Last Supper, because there are many others beside Leonardo's, and most of them also use this kind of clothesline composition, but quite a few of them have Judas sitting alone on the near side of the table with Jesus and all the other apostles sitting on the far side of the table. Now, we know that Dreyer looked at more than one Last Supper. And this is some notes that are found in his personal copy of the screenplay. And we can see that it says Ghirlandaio, picture Abbildung in German, number 6, The Last Supper, Leonardo da Vinci, figure 43 to 45, the same motif, and von Gebhardt, number 19, the same. I haven't been able to find, it must be some German art history book that has these pictures, but I haven't been able to find the right one. But if we look at the pictures, we can see that the Ghirlandaio picture again uses the clothesline composition, but that one is one of the ones with Judas on the near side of the table. Dreyer actually does the same. Judas is sitting there, but it's he's not sort of censored the way the other ones are. And the other one is a picture from 1870 by a German painter, Eduard von Gebhardt. And I've only been able to find this black and white reproduction of it. But there is this tries for sort of a more realistic version, and so the people are have been moved more closely together, and more people are sitting on this side of the table, and some of them just happen to have gotten up to, I don't know, go off to the back or something, so that we can still see what's going on with Jesus. But in that way, it tries for sort of a less obviously theatrical arrangement than the Renaissance one. And there is little of that in Dreyer, but one should also note that he insisted on archaeologically correct detail. He has also many, many annotations of books about Near Eastern archaeology that reconstruct what objects in Roman Palestine looked like, and a lot of that he tried to get in. The floor also is much rougher and different from the kinds of sort of obviously non-ancient spaces and backgrounds that you see in the paintings that he took as a model. So he did, although he sort of took the general composition, he didn't sort of try to reproduce the paintings exactly the way that the American Ben-Hur film did, for instance. But another place in the same screenplay where there's also a visual analogy is in the second episode, the Spanish Inquisition one, where there is a reference here to Horses presentation, see Mimling title page. José is the major domo in the household of this elderly man who is he's a man of science, but that means that he's also an astrologer, and that gets him in trouble with the Inquisition. José is the one who informs on him to the inquisitors, so he's a rather villainous character, it's not actually in the finished film, it's not actually sort of the first we see of José, but in this case I did manage to find the book that I was referring to, a book about the early Dutch painter Hans Memling, a fully illustrated book with 197 pictures from 1909, and on the title or next to the title page is this illustration called Memling's self-portrait, and in Dyer's script it says Memling title page. And here we have José looking in through a curtain, spying on his master. And the I think that there is a clear sort of similarity to this painting. Now the interesting thing is that the compositional detail that seems to have intrigued Dyer, sort of the black cloth hanging down and sort of dividing the image, is really sort of an artifact of this detail being pulled out by the editor of the book, because he wanted to show what he believed to be Memling's self-portrait. But what we have here is actually a very, very small detail of a much bigger picture, the Donne triptych in the National Gallery, where the figure in question appears way off in the back, observing the Virgin with Child and angels and saints and so on. So, and we can see there that the dark object is actually a pillar and not a drapery. So we can't really say that Dyer took this compositional detail from Memling, but rather from the way that the editor of the book decided to cut out a detail from Memling's picture. So it's as much Carl Foll the art historian as it is the painter who inspired this emotional and dramatic effect. But it was clearly something that he was pleased with, and there is this is not from the film. This is a production still that reproduces the image that we just saw. But I think that the fact that they had a production still made of precisely this shot also suggests that this was a shot that they thought was a good shot and was worth using to promote the film with. And in the case of The President, which he made just before, it's well known, and this is something that Dyer has talked about himself, that he used the paintings of Wilhelm Hammershøi, who was a very, very important Danish painter who had died in 1916, as a model for his sets. Right after his death, there had been a very, very large retrospective exhibition of his paintings that Dreyer could presumably have seen, and also they were quite widely reproduced at the time. And Ole Olsen actually owned a Hammershøi painting, so there were different places where Dreyer could have been aware of Hammershøi, but sort of the spareness of the spaces, the paneling, and so on, is clearly very similar. There are other places as well where, and this is of course part of the same. This is also from the house of the Chief Justice, but the style is quite quite evidently similar. But I think that there's actually more to this, and one of the things that Bordwell points out in his analysis of Presidenten is that in Presidenten we get a number of shots with what he calls a gaping floor, so that you have a number of shots where instead of what you would get in tableau style compositions, where you would usually have important stuff at in the foreground, Dreyer pushes thing into the background and leaves a relatively flat background, and then gives us a view of relatively large expanses of floor, of empty space in the foreground of the image. So, in a sense, leaving air here rather than, I mean, and it's not really intended to sort of create a dynamic between the back and the front, but instead to have this sort of sense of openness. And interestingly, this is something that appears in Hammershøi's paintings as well. You have this sense of rather large expanses of floors, and you get it in the Netherlandish paintings that Hollander talks about as dramatic, and even in the Balestieri painting that we looked at that inspired many films, you have this same sort of open floor area, and I think that it was it seems likely that it was by looking at paintings that featured this compositional device that made Dreyer want to use it in The President. And you get it in The Last Supper as well. Big open floor there. Okay. How are we doing for time? Problem with what's it called? Leaves from Satan's Book was that it was very expensive, and I wanted it to be even more expensive. He wanted a big scene of the trial of Marie Antoinette, and which would require lots and lots of costumed extras and big sets, and Nordisk refused that, and Dreyer was furious and wrote angry letters to the management, some of which survives and survive, and they're quite intemperate. And so Dreyer went looking for another job, and he got one in Sweden doing a film called The Parson's Widow, which may have been a project that was started by Scandia Film, but by the time the film went into production, Scandia and Svenska Bio had been merged into this new company called SF, Svenska Filmkompaniet, or today Svensk Filmindustri. It still exists. And this was a film that was shot in Norway. It takes place somewhat further back in history than most of the other Swedish Golden Age films. It's set in the 17th century, and Dreyer shot it almost entirely on location, not just the exteriors, but the interiors as well, were shot at this open-air museum in Norway, where old buildings from different parts of Norway had been brought together. So they disassembled the physical buildings and reassembled them as this museum of Norwegian folk architecture, you could say, and Dreyer shot the whole film there, was quite fascinated by the sort of the effects of having to work with real buildings rather than sets, because it necessitated a very different way of working, and there were obviously various sorts of complications. Bringing lighting into these old buildings was complicated. They had to set up a generator to provide the electricity for the lighting, and all the actors got Klieg eyes because the light was Klieg eyes was this sort of inflammation of the eyes that affected many silent film actors, because the lights that they used were so powerful that it had it really hurt the eyes. And there are a few sort of films that show where you can see, there's one of a Swedish film in production, and you can see that all the technicians are wearing these dark goggles to protect their eyes, and only the actors are and of course the lights that they used were in many cases, you know, the kinds of searchlights that had been developed in World War I, you know, to track zeppelins and airplanes way up in the sky. But of course, you know, they were placed right in front of people rather than miles away, and horrible. But that was the kind of illumination that was required to get this to work in in interiors, at least. Okay. This is how it starts out, I think. Thank you. So, Maya also made a big effort to cast authentic looking locals. So all the bushy beards you see are sort of genuine Norwegian bushy beards. And this was, for him, I think, working in Sweden was not just where he could get a job, but it was also something that he wanted to do because he had been very, very impressed with the Swedish film, and he wrote an essay early in 1920 where he praises the Swedish filmmakers, and particularly Victor Sjöström with great enthusiasm. And he also has some rather nasty things to say about Danish film. The Danish films are, you know, they're manufactured like a factory product, and they are the kind of thing that make people of taste hold their noses. And and you know, you wouldn't think that this was actually written by the man who'd, you know, done screenplays for at least 20 pictures of this sort and edited even more. But there you go. And obviously also by this time, Nordisk had shifted their production policy, and they weren't sort of more in the direction of the Swedes. They weren't as successful with it, perhaps because they didn't quite have filmmakers of the caliber of Sjöström and Stiller, except maybe for Dreyer, and they did hire him, and he went way, way over budget and made himself impossible. So I think that sort of the critique that has sometimes been offered of Nordisk for sort of not adapting to the new conditions after World War I is a bit unfair, and perhaps also marked by this early essay by Dreyer, which many people have read, and which is sort of is very one-sided in the way that it portrays things. But clearly, one of the things that Dreyer really, really admired about the Swedish filmmakers was their commitment to authenticity, both of setting, of props, but also to try to have. He talks about how in Ingmar Sönerne, Sjöström and the other actors move slowly and ponderously, and that there had been complaints about that because it didn't go fast enough, but that Sjöström was right because that was the way that peasants actually moved, that they had this sort of heavy, slow gait, and that Sjöström had sort of been willing to sacrifice speed to artistic truth, and I think also that Dreyer liked the model of the literary film, he wrote an essay about Hexen also just before it came out, before he'd seen it probably, but where he makes some comments about another essay that Christensen had written, where he suggests that film directors should be film authors. Filmdichter is the word he used. It's the same word as Dichter in German, which means poet, but can sort of be extended to mean any kind of creator. Basically, Christensen argued that the filmmaker should be this sort of controlling artistic figure who should write his own scripts and be sort of the decisive shaper of the whole work, and sounds in that way very much like sort of later auteurism, you could say. But Dreyer said, no, this is wrong, that the film director should be the servant of the literary material, and Dreyer's conception, at least as he lays it out in this essay, is actually closer to the idea of the stage director, who should be sort of the servant of the playwright's work rather than sort of the master of the whole thing, in the way that Christensen describes. You may argue that, well, that Dreyer did that anyway, but it's also clear that nearly all his films were based on pre-existing literary works. Leaves from Satan's Book is the only sort of real exception, but again, there was an original screenplay there that he worked from, and in all the other cases, Dreyer adapted pre-existing literary works, and he actually in this period would buy up literary rights to books that he wanted to film, and so that sort of that side of the Swedish example was also something that he thoroughly approved of, and subsequently, he came back to Denmark, and this is a Swedish poster, but it was a Danish film called Once Upon a Time, which came out in 1922, and which is quite clearly an attempt to sort of to emulate what had been successful about the Swedish films, but with a Danish subject matter, and Davan Gang was a sort of an explicitly nationalistic play that had come out, that had first been performed in the 1880s, and was very popular. As the title suggests, it's a fairy tale story. Sort of it's quite close to Hans Christian Andersen's tale, The Swineherd, for the first part, and there are other sort of folk tales that it draws on for the rest of the plot. But basically, this haughty princess from the faraway kingdom of Illyria is tricked by a wily tinker who's actually the Prince of Denmark in disguise, and she's rejected the prince, but she ends up having to marry the poor tinker instead and live with him in a hut in the woods, and there she's gradually comes to love him, and at the end she would rather have him than the prince. When she's given the choice, and it turns out that they're one and the same. So, but it's in some ways it's a terribly misogynistic story about how women should be shaped to the will of their men. Usually in modern day performances of the play, sort of the most egregious parts of the text are cut out, and I think that Dreyer's film also softens that aspect of it. But a very important part of the film is the use of the landscape, the same thing the Swedes were famed for, and in this case it's particularly the woods, the Danish forests, that are used to create this atmosphere. And the film was very, very successful in Denmark, but didn't really sell well elsewhere, and it was produced as sort of a one-off by a producer who had close ties Svenska Bio, Svenska Film Company. He was the one who distributed their films in Denmark. So in that way too, it's closely linked to the Swedish cinema.
Thank you.
In the original play, there's a big market scene where the princess comes with her pots, and a knight comes along and breaks all the pots. And that's actually the prince himself in disguise. So he breaks the pots that she has laboriously made just to teach her a lesson about the proper place of women in society. And in Dreyer's screenplay, there was a big market sequence, but at some point it was probably decided that that would be too expensive. So instead you get the scene here with, you know, with four guys and the wheelbarrow, which was obviously less costly to shoot, but which also has the effect of making this this destructive act be something that, that occurs randomly, rather than something which is part of the prince's deliberate plan to break the stubborn will of the woman, and thus makes him more sympathetic and their eventual reconciliation probably a bit more acceptable. We don't exactly know what that would have been like, because the only print that survives of the film is incomplete. About one third of the film is missing, which is unfortunate, because it's what we have is beautiful and charming, but alas, such are the woes of film history. Anyway, at the same time, sort of Nordisk's biggest investment, you could say, were films that adapted the novels of Charles Dickens. A.W. Sandberg had become the top director at the company, and there were a couple of others that were working during the 20s, but Sandberg was actually the only director who was working there consistently, and he would typically make two or three features per year, but that still meant that production was much, much smaller than it had been in 1915-16, when Nordisk made more than 100 films per year, even if they were somewhat shorter and less expensive. And in some ways, you can say that the Dickens films are sort of actually Nordisk's way of adapting the Svenska production policy. Whereas in Norway and Finland, what they did was that they tried to make films that were just like the Swedish ones, as the Norwegians basically remaking Sunniva Solbakken over and over. In Denmark, the response was slightly different, and Davangang, which was Once Upon a Time, which was sort of independently produced, you could say, was the only film that in Denmark that really tried to do Danishness the way that Ingmar Sunnerne and other of those films could be said to do Swedishness. Instead, most of the other sort of elements of the policy, getting the best directors possible and giving them extensive influence over the final product, putting a lot of money into each film, having impressive sets and that kind of thing, and using well-known and prestigious literature as the basis. Those were all elements of the Dickens films, but of course they weren't Danish at all. They took great care to try to reproduce in sets built in Denmark the look of our 19th century England as closely as possible. The characters were made up to look like some of the illustrations in popular editions of Dickens's work, and the aim was obviously to get these films into the international market, and particularly the British one, with mixed success, it must be said. But I mean, Sandberg has not really been sort of canonized by film history the way that Sjöström or Stiller or Dreyer has, and one can also argue that he is aesthetically a much less interesting director. But it's very clear at the time that a lot of people thought very, very highly of him as a director, and you see repeatedly in reviews, it's a good thing that we have a master filmmaker like Sandberg. So giving him this kind of role, and you can see also that his is the biggest name on the poster, right? Was something that, in a sense, was similar to the policies that Svenska took with Sjöström and Stiller. And this is just a little bit from Great Expectations. I'm afraid this is not great quality, but you can see there's a really, really big set back there, a meticulous reconstruction of an early 19th century coaching inn. You childish person, won't you ever get any wiser than you were the first time you saw me? Don't you remember a thing? Don't remember a thing? Oh yes, Pip remembered everything, including his last visit to Miss Havisham. Love her. If she approaches you, love her. If she tears your heart to pieces, love her. Sort of the most successful part of Danish cinema in the 20s were the comic duo Pat and Patterson, in Danish Fyrtårnet og Bivognen, which means the lighthouse and the trailer. They were also called Long and Short for obvious reasons. Later their names were shortened to Fy and Bi, short for Fyrtårnet and Bivognen. But in many European countries, they were known as Pat and Patterson, and they were very popular, particularly in Europe. They never managed to sort of break into the American market, but they had a big following in Germany and Austria and. Maybe here too. I don't know how about the impact of Pat and Patterson in Czech lands, but They in Germany in particular, they remained very popular until quite recently, and unfortunately that meant that German television acquired the negatives for the films and recut them and dubbed them with German soundtracks, and in many cases those are the only accessible versions of the films, and that's unfortunately also what I have to show here. Fyrtårnet og Bivognen, Pat and Bastion, are gentle, very sort of childlike fellows, and usually the films involves some sort of young romance story. There's a boy and a girl who can't get each other, and these two who are tramps then get involved and sort of create various problems for themselves, and then everything is tied up neatly at the end. Parts of the films are often shot on location and in a sense using Danish landscapes of various sorts, and sort of that's another place where you can say that you get a bit of extra Danishness in the films of this period. What I have here is a film called Vestervovo, which is sort of a child nickname for the North Sea, which is Vesterhavet in Danish. So it takes place along the west coasts of Jutland, and in the scene here, the two have gone to a ball at the local inn, but the girls won't dance with them, so they have to dance with each other.
Hier scheint die Schwiegermüttersorte zu sein. Sven hier Riesen, der Fischhändler, lässt es sich nicht nehmen, die neuen Bürger willkommen zu heißen. Dabei kann er sich nicht verkneifen, auf all die Sorten Dänens hinzuweisen, die da versammelt sind. Ist das nicht schön? Komm mal ran. Leider gehen die Sorten dir ins richtige warmen Sinne. Sogar Einzelne sind nicht zu haben. Tja, Sven Heringsen scheint aber auch nicht viel Glück bei den Dänen zu haben. Denn seine Tänzerin, die Wirtstochter Elke, hat nur für Uwe Augen, der gerade reingekommen ist. Ich möchte eigentlich nur mit dir tanzen, Uwe. Aber Tante Trine will, dass ich mit diesem Fischhändler tanzen soll. Da ist er. Abend. Und in Ermangelung besserer Möglichkeiten entschließen sich die Herren Neubürger kurzerhand, mit sich selbst eine Kesselsohle aufs Parkett zu legen. Weil Sie nun schon mal dabei sind, machen Sie ein großes Fass auf und zeigen den einmaligen Superschatz Ihre persönliche Herzen.
Ha 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 ha
Mit dieser Leistung haben die Herren Neuburger den Respekt des ganzen Dorfes gewonnen. Auch wenn sie bisher noch keine einzige Krabbe gefangen haben. Was geht es?
All right. That's it for now.